You've seen Stable Diffusion, OpenAI, and all these. They're great, great, you know, fantastic, you know, the astronaut sitting on the horse on the moon, great stuff. That won't work in a world where it has to be super photorealistic in a moving video.
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
Hello and welcome to Paleo EdTech. I'm Marty Kine.
And I'm Jill Royce, and we are the hosts of this podcast that looks at the first two decades of advertising and marketing technology.
From double click to double verify and everything in between.
Get your name out there.
Today, we are very happy to welcome Omar Talkol to the program. Omar was the CEO of the pioneering data management platform BlueKai from 2007 until it was acquired by Oracle in 2014. He led Oracle's data cloud until 2016 or so, when he founded Voicea, which was sold to Cisco in 2019. He was also the GM of product-led growth at WebEx, a Cisco division, and is now CEO and co-founder of Rembrandt. Were you a marketing junkie from the beginning, or that come about later?
I definitely was an entrepreneur from the beginning. I remember my first failed enterprise, 5 years old. I saw these little coasters that were really cool. So I made my own, sold it to a neighbor, and my parents were like, no, they just bought it out of pity. We really didn't need to return the money.
5 years old. That's a record for our program. So you started a company called Co-Relation in 1998. What did Co-Relation do, Omar? Was that your first sort of successful enterprise?
You know, Co-Relation was a lot of fun. So what it did was like very straightforward. We were a recommendation system as a SaaS service. So essentially, and our first client was Barnes & Noble because they weren't going to use Amazon's tech. And our second was Nordstrom and CDW. So it was really cool stuff. And I had like a bunch of PhDs from Stanford. We essentially, I learned.
So you built a recommendation engine?
Recommendation engine. Yep. Okay. It was, I loved it, man. We built some awesome tech and we had awesome clients, and the team was like very full of propeller heads. I think and we got
was a collaborative filtering.
No. It was actually several flavors, like the basic collaborative filtering. The first algorithm was just people that bought that, like just really, you could simply write that with a single SQL query that's not so complicated. But once you do collaborative filtering, it's better performance. And then what we started to do is specialize in low data situations where it's a new product or a product that didn't have a ton of recommendation transaction data on it. We would do things like look at the content written about the product, related to other products, and learn from there. And we started to experiment with concepts called ensembles, which would use multiple algorithmic approaches, and then some algorithm at the top figures out how to pull them together. We got acquired quite early on, and my lesson there, in terms of yes, it was an acquisition that was great, but it was acquisition by another much bigger startup, and so the liquidity wasn't real. So that was and that became Audience.
So not financially lucrative for you personally.
No, and that became Audience Science. So you know
that
why
became pretty well known.
Where that went.
Okay, because I remember back to the collaborative filtering and ensemble models, there was the Netflix prize.
Before people
would enter the prize and try to come up with the best recommendation engine for films, and it was a big deal. It's like $1 million. Yeah.
This was 2000 and 2001, way before that.
Okay.
The thing I love most about the Netflix prize was the simple conclusion early on in the debate that what wins, better algorithms or more data? The answer is more data.
That's true. They didn't implement the algorithm. And eventually, it just threw it out. So Audience Science, this is around 2000. There was a dot-com, you know, boom, the dot-com bust. 2000 was right around the bust. And then you were CMO of Audience Science during that difficult period. Well, how did the company adapt to the market? And what were you selling in that period?
You know, in the early days of Audience Science, before it was Audience Call, it was a science. It had a name, Revenue Science. And what we were doing early days is analytics and data mining. So data mining was like our recommendation system, was an example of the data mining and customer segmentation, stuff like that, and analytics. And at the time, there's, I think early on in our history, we were as big as Omniture in terms of analytics. So we were at Omniture at that time, not Omniture now. At some point, what we decided to do was specialize and not be general analytics and say, let's apply segmentation to media and really focus on understanding audiences for publishers and advertisers. That was a decision we made at some board meeting, I can't remember, maybe 2003, because at that time it was, you know, in the market, Dave Morgan, Takoda, was our fierce competitor at the time. And, you know, for some strange reason, I've always been a big fan of his, even though I was competing with him.
Very charming.
Yeah, and he's very insightful.
Yeah, so. Seems like it. But Takoda was behavioral targeting, sort of retargeting, intelligent retargeting of media, right? Was that the area you were in with audience science?
Absolutely. It was yeah. Fairly head-to-head, but just slightly different business models.
Yeah.
So, but you know, and I think they built a network at some point. We also built a network, but we were early on focused more CPC, more automated long tail, and they were like more curated high end. But you know, there was convergence over time.
It's quite different than web analytics, though. It's a different business. So that was a pivot, basically, right?
Yeah, I think it was. I think at some point there was a CEO change around that time.
Yeah.
And after that time, that pivot occurred, which, you know, somehow often happens with new CEOs.
It does. You're correct. And they saw growth and retargeting. So you were not acquired by Yahoo, though, I noticed. Was that ever potential?
In terms of audience science, there were several potentials. And there was, it got really close. But I to protect quite. The innocent, I won't say who. It educated me in the domain. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. You really got to know everyone. And, you know, this last week in New York, I practically saw all the exact same people. So it was very interesting.
It's a small world, without a doubt.
It sure is. So can we talk a little bit about Blue Kai? What was the original vision there in 2007? Where'd the idea come from?
Blue Kai was a very charmed, I almost blessed experience from the perspective of I kind of knew what I wanted to do. And that was I wanted to create a winning data company in the media business that wouldn't ever serve an ad. And the insight that I had was, you know, based on kind of blue ocean strategies that I saw the emergence of this new thing back then. You know, we came up with the idea in 2007, executed it into the January of 2008. And back then there were these emerging ad networks, lots of them. And I basically said, they all need better data. And I fundamentally believe that the more value in the ad unit will be the data over time. And there are so many people competing over the ad unit. So let's step back, become the data and data infrastructure to power the entire ecosystem. And my belief at the time was if I was going to start a more intelligent ad company with data, I needed to believe I could be number one. And I honestly didn't. Like, I'm not going to be Google. Facebook was a thing that was emerging, but you know, Yahoo and Microsoft and all these other players are already there. And I started myself, okay, well, I'm going to be number one. No. Number two. No. Three. In a super, you know, wonderful world, maybe four. I'm like, that's not a way to start a company, but I could be number one in data. And that produced a 8-slide pitch deck. And till I left Oracle after the Oracle Data Cloud, we were still executing to that pitch deck with a little bit added in terms of licensing the technology as a DMP. That part was new.
That's pretty incredible. How did you make money?
We started out with a bid system. We put intent data on one side. And the reason we started intent data is that was not available in the market. There was lots of other data, lifestyle data, demographic data, but no one was really focused on intent data. And we started our launch with eBay, Cars.com, Expedia, and Kayak. So awesome compared to anything in the market. So we started with intent data on one side, and then we just went to ad networks for the first 9 months. It was mainly ad networks. On the other, ad networks knew how to use data. They knew how to draw up a pixel operationally. They could sign a contract and be running the next day. And when we opened up a bid system very early on, and so you literally just bid on the price of having your pixel fired. And we solve the conundrum of how do you create an auction when there is no scarcity? Data could be resold 50 billion times. So under what pretext should anyone bid higher? And we simply basically said, we're only going to fire n pixels on the page, because if I'm Expedia, I don't want to add 1,000 pixels to load on my page. And so if you want to be one of the N, you had to bid, and you want to be the first in those N because you have no guarantee the person's going to stay on the page long enough for the second pixel to load. So that created scarcity. And what's so interesting about that is if we had known a decade later there was going to be this thing called an NFT, that would have been the perfect solution for this concept of scarcity. So this was a fake NFT, like, before its time. NFT is a much, much, much more elegant solution.
Ahead of your time.
So in your 8-page pitch deck, did you carve out certain industries where you thought that there would be more potential? So you mentioned eBay and cars.com and kayaks. So it seems like automotive and hotels would be some area where you like intent data would have a lot of value.
So in the pitch deck, it started with the idea of like it's data. And then when we got to like how we're going to implement, we realized that we needed to get focus. So we said we're going to start out with travel, auto, and then retail. And then even within retail, it had subcategories. And so we needed focus so we could have liquidity both on the demand side and the sell side. Yeah. And it's a theme that if you're building a marketplace, getting early focus as opposed to just doing a platform that's empty is very important.
Was it a difficult sell to the ad networks or to the on the buy side? Did they have any trouble envisioning what the value would be? And No,
it wasn't difficult. I mean, for the early folks we deal with, the folks like Dave Jakubowski, I remember we were
ended up at Facebook. Yeah.
Yeah, we were in our office. We hadn't even installed our furniture yet. He visited and we talked about what we're doing. He's like, "Great. When can I go live?" Like, so the early folks really, really understood the value prop. That's why we started with ad networks. We would then every 6 to 9 months revisit the trend on, okay, now there are DSPs. Now there are the kind of like the portals and then the data marketplaces. We started like really expanding, but each, period in time, we had this very strong focus on deeply satisfying this new customer type.
So in the beginning, you didn't have competitors, huh? Except maybe these behavioral networks.
The behavioral networks were not really our competitor. They ended up being our customer because of the fact that they bundled data and media. So for even like a company like Datalogix had an ad network that bundled the two, a bunch of these. So you could partner with all these guys by saying, I'm not going to compete with you by ever selling an ad. The only pure play competitor that we had was Xlate, and Xlate at that time was more focused on demographic data and not intent, and that was our calling card on differentiation. We got so lucky. If you remember, MediaPost used to have these events where they get the agency and the tech vendors and they do this dating scene.
Yeah.
Where 1 minute dating, you go talk to an agency, give me your card, you have 1 minute to say who you are and you move on. I went to that and I'm in like my second pitch and they said, I already spoke to the folks at Blue Sky. As a matter of fact, I saw two people from Blue Sky. And I'm thinking to myself, well, they can't because we're not even that big. But okay. So I'm like, who? And she pointed to two ad networks with our early customers. And in their 1 minute pitch, they said, by the way, we have access to this new thing called Blue Sky, which is intent data. Nobody else has it. So that kind of got our name spread pretty fast.
Well, I remember I was at Digitas, at the time, and it did seem like a kind of a secret. They're like, oh yeah, we're using Blue Sky. It's this kind of, it's a secret. It's a data secret. So the DMP came along later, I guess, the idea of selling, package software as a data management platform. So you have said in the past that it was your customer's idea, that the idea kind of came from requests from your customers. Is that true? And how did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, so what would happen is for there were two types of customers that we'd speak to that drove us to the DMP.
Yeah.
And a lot of credit for like deep thinking from folks like Alex Hushmand, who was one of our co-founders and very strategic about the stuff, is that our data providers kept saying, hey, I know we're using your marketplace to sell data, but we want to do our own deals. And we don't want you to take your rev share cut for that. We really view it as like a technology. You're our technology partner, but we don't need you to be our business partner on that. So we started building very early on DMP capabilities. As a matter of fact, our first real customer of that was Datalogix. And if you remember Chris Scoggins, he was the one on the other side of the negotiations, like, Omar, I don't need your business side of this. I just need your tech. And so we started building all the features for them. We just didn't call it a DMP, and we took a different rev share when they did one thing versus another. So that was like the early version of the DMP. Then we'd go speak to some brands and talk about why we had the best data in the world. And I remember some of these brands would be like, hey, I'm HP. I have first party data. It's awesome. And before I'm going to pay you to value your stuff, I need better understanding of my own data. Can you do something for us? And that's when we started realizing. Yeah, that's when we started realizing that the best way to compete with BlueKai would be to quit BlueKai and start a company that just gave the tech. And that would give us a run for the money. And we're like, well, if such a competitor is going to emerge and give us some problem, let's disrupt ourselves.
That it's a very similar to, in a different way, DoubleClick, because they had an ad network and they had an ad server. And then they had Wall Street Journal. It was like, actually, we just want this ad server. We don't want your ad network. It sounds like, I guess it's an old story.
It's a common theme. Yeah. When I later get to tell you what I'm going to do next, that same theme will appear at some point in the history too. It is a very common theme. It has to do with just like the maturity as people, you know, look at the maturity of it. They don't want the one-stop solution. They want to kind of disaggregate pieces.
Do you think you were the first DMP?
I do think that there was a company that was faster in terms of, we had a DMP, I'd say before anyway, but it wasn't called a DMP. Mm. But there was a company who figured out they need to purely sell it on its own. And it was bought by Adobe.
Demdex?
Demdex. That's right. And so what kind of used to annoy us about Demdex is we were in market with features that were DMP-like with Datalogix and these other folks, you know, before Demdex even appeared on the scene. But as soon as they appeared on the scene, this was their pitch. They're like, oh, you don't want to give your first-party data to BlueKai. They're going to sell it. And we'd be like, no. We have a feature that allows you to have your first-party data that we're not allowed to sell. We're not dishonest. Like, that's a feature. And we realized, yeah, that's too much of a nuance. So when we launched the DMP, we made it religiously different than the exchange. We actually had the sales team and customer success team, they couldn't work in the exchange. Mm-hmm. We had to make it
so two different teams. Yeah.
To make it clear to the market that these are two different things. And you get the benefits of the exchange sitting in your DMP, but the opposite is not true.
Brilliant. Where was the BlueKai office? What was your culture like?
Oh, the culture of BlueKai was like very fun. When I still meet people now, I run into lots of people who are just like, you know, they still meet, they still go to like parties and weddings together. And there's a lot of camaraderie from those teams. And the culture was, it was pretty low drama. It was very GSD. That's something that I've put in all the companies I've subsequently created is get stuff done, experiment, iterate fast. Learn. It had a little bit of emphasis on thought leadership, on always kind of working on the innovative edge with our clients and internally. And it had this cultural attribute called charity, which everybody misunderstood when I first brought it up. And what I meant by charity is for a company that really pushes everybody for goals, a lot of times people internally have to interact and help each other, even if it doesn't maximize their goal today. And I saw that in the character of the people, and it was a beautiful thing. So we had that as one of our cultural pillars called charity. And at first people thought that meant we need to take time off and go serve other charities. Like, no, that's a good thing. Go do that. But that's not what I mean.
No, it's actually more self-serving.
Well, you're going back to the Latin root of the word, I think, which is just caring. So
that's awesome. How did the Oracle deal happen in 2014? And did you have any hesitation about that?
It was a miracle, actually, the way it went down.
A miracle.
I'll tell you why. You'll see what I'm saying. It's December of 2013. There are no conversations with anybody. We're actually not thinking of selling. We wanted to buy LiveRamp at the time. This was LiveRamp before Axiom, when it was standalone. And it was more of a merger. And my pitch to the board was, we are cookie data. These guys are doing the link between known data and cookie data. In 2013, I told my board, one day the cookie will crumble. And if we want to be a public company, if we combine no data with this, like a pitch for a CDP before CDPs, we need to take DMPs beyond cookie data into this broader known data world. Why don't we acquire or merge with them? We were slightly bigger, but still it would have been a merger. And let's IPO within 18 months. And they're like, awesome plan.
Brilliant.
And I show them the price. And then I show them the price tag. They're like, oh, dude, you need to convince us a little better, but you want that. And then in that same time period, three public companies knocked on our door within 2 weeks and said, we want to acquire you. And just out of nowhere, like I have no idea why that happened at once. Oracle was one of them. And they're the ones who won the bid.
You really don't know why that all happened at the same time?
No, I might have found religion, but I really don't know why.
That's good.
Well, I was on the outside. I think their marketing clouds were starting to get serious about forming marketing clouds, and they began to believe they needed a DMP as kind of core to that proposition. So that was part of it. And Adobe had acquired Demdex. So Oracle's like, well, who's out there? Blue Sky, they're big, something like that.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. What I didn't understand is the other players. Coincidentally, the same 2 weeks. It was just very like all of a sudden.
Yeah.
But anyway,
were they marketing clouds? Yeah.
One was another player in the data space. You know, a well-known name in the data space, and another one was another ad tech player who had gone public.
So then at Oracle, you're acquired in and they formed the data cloud and you start to run the data cloud. And I mean, from the outside, it was a little confusing because there was marketing cloud and there was data cloud. How did Blue Sky fit within that picture?
Yeah. So Larry Ellison, I sat down with him literally the day of the close, 2-hour meeting, went through everything. And he said, look, if we integrate the DMP fits in the marketing cloud, it's a piece of the MarTech architecture, but your data business doesn't look like anything else we have. And if we fully integrate it, we'll kill it. And I've always wanted to see an ability to actually monetize data. So we're going to create another business unit. You're going to run it and tell me how you want to grow it through organic growth and acquisition. And I'm like, okay. And he kept looking at me after he said that sentence. So I'm like, oh, you want me to actually tell you now? Who you're going to buy? He said, yeah. I said, can I come back next week? And we came back with a really cool map next week that really explained how an identity graph was going to be core to how these systems work and what it would take to build one. We put out a map and we went out and bought a bunch of things on that map.
Well, you acquired Crosswise, Moat, Datalogix.
Add this.
Yeah, quite a few companies.
Yep.
Building up the data cloud. Okay, so that was a result of the mapping exercise?
Correct. And that obviously we revisited the map and dived into things and so on. But it was good to have a proactive map as opposed to getting a call every few weeks from corp dev saying, hey, someone's for sale if you want it. It's like, no, that's not a way to do it.
So I've never met Larry Ellison. I know he's the original for Iron Man, Robert Downey Jr. That's the rumor anyway. Is he like that character? I mean, is he
I don't know about Robert Downey Jr. I'll tell you what impressed me when I met Larry in that first meeting and several others. He walks into the room and he sat with you for 2 hours, never distracted, fully engaged, diving deep, not getting like, not being satisfied with high level words or high level, like he needed to understand and he would give you the attention to understand. He was very sharp and fully engaged. It's one of the things I've found on leaders like him, you know, Satya at Microsoft, a few other leaders like that, where you spend time with them and they're with you. You know, I'm with, people you meet all the time and some of them are with you and then looking at their phone and they're distracted or they're mentally distracted. No, these guys, like their time is very utilized.
So just one last question on Oracle. Blue Sky, the DMP, sat within the marketing cloud. So how did that go?
Yeah, so we took the DMP, put it in the marketing cloud, and put the data business in the Oracle data cloud.
Yeah.
And the DMP was growing faster before the acquisition than the data business. And this was a beautiful M&A structure A/B test. Take one business, fully integrate it. Take the marketing people, put them in the greater marketing. Take customer success, change the model of customer success. You know, every product, integrate them into product. Fully integrated across multiple entities versus, Blue Sky standalone Oracle Data Cloud. And before we acquired anything else, it had some time to grow. Yeah. And then even when we required other things, we gave them freedom at the beginning to say, I will not scramble the eggs. Come in exactly as they are, run it as if it's an independent company, and you help us design how to integrate. So those are two different approaches. Jam it day one, scramble the eggs, and say this is a meal that gets sold together. The other one is, we will protect you as you are, grow as fast as you used to grow, but we will thoughtfully take time to integrate you. And what was happened was amazing. The Oracle Data Cloud data business grew as fast and even faster than when it was on its own. And the DMP grew slower than it was independent. And ever since then, since I acquired companies, both at the Oracle Data Cloud and then later at Cisco, I've always had this concept of the acquirer comes in like a conqueror. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know which exit they're breaking. And it still looks good to them because they're so damn big and they're growing that they think it's a good idea. I much prefer really valuing the thing you bought and making them your thought partner and taking your time in the integration to integrate it, to accelerate and not be satisfied with slower growth.
Can we talk a little bit about Voicea? Where did that idea come from? What problem were you solving there?
I remember this experience of meeting in the very last days of Blue Sky, just when Satya was going to become the CEO of Microsoft. And he was just taking over. And I met him at a cafe at 5 p.m. We departed at 6. I got home at 7, and an email was written to me from him with the action items. I'm like, how does he have time? He's like one of the busiest people on the planet. How could he possibly have beaten me to writing up the follow-up? So the thing here was, how can we build technology that would enable people to be really productive, go to a meeting and identify all the action items, do the follow-ups, send them out, have them put into a system of record, like, you know, a Trello board or a CRM or something like that. That was the vision. Build an AI assistant that would make, you know, the rest of us as good as the best of us.
Good line. I like it. I might have to steal that.
It's not my line.
Is that a quote, Omar?
it's not mine. There's a gentleman called Zach at WebEx. When he heard what I was saying, he got it down to that. So credit goes to him.
Brilliance. Yes. How about Cisco? How did the Cisco acquisition happen? And what was your role there?
Was it a miracle? Yes. Another miracle.
You're
a charmed life.
I wasn't necessarily mentally ready to sell because we were just Series A and we were growing super fast and it was a fun area.
Just 2 years, right?
It was just 2 years. One of my co-founders, the CTO, would have preferred a sale because at the time he discovered he had MS and he basically was like, you know, this could be 30 years. Like it could be fine. But you know, if we were part of a bigger one, maybe the stress would be a little less and, you know, and my family, I could feel better about and stuff like that. So I looked at him and I said, look, I can't sell the company. That's not a good outcome. We have to get bought. And I'm not going to put a shingle up for sale, but I now know how you feel. So I will keep that in the back of my head. And that was it. We moved on. And that conversation was like 6 months before something happened. We started working with WebEx. We started opening up an API for them to tap into. And they did an accuracy test of our system versus Google's. And they found that we were, you know, within one percentage point. We were actually 1% higher. I'll tell you how, because we cheated and it was an allowable cheat.
But very
close.
I'll
explain what it was. Yeah. And then they said, great, I need you to, I have to tell you how we cheated so you know what they asked us to change. We built an ensemble and we were public about it. The way the ensemble worked is we built our own two algorithms and then we plugged in Google as a third and we could take any external engine that's third. And then we trained the algorithm to take the inputs in and then in real time come up with the best possible answer. So we were always able to beat any of the engines we put in at the ensemble level. So they're like, okay, you're the most accurate thing we've seen, but it's expensive because I'm paying your processing fees plus you're paying Google. So can you please rip out Google, only use your internal engines and still at least match Google? So we went into a cave for about 8 weeks as a team, ripped out Google, did all the stuff our own. We came back and we still actually, we were probably within half a percentage point. My team would say we're half a percentage point better, but let's just say we're equal at way lower cost. And to be clear, we weren't beating Google in everything. We were just beating them in the context of WebEx meetings. We were fine-tuned for meeting dynamics, not for, you know, a YouTube or some other scenario, like dictation. It was for meetings, and that's where we shined. So within 2 weeks, they gave us an offer to acquire us when they saw that.
What was your role at Cisco?
So I'll start with just the end to make it simple. Product-led growth is the antithesis of how Cisco used to sell. And today in the main, Cisco will sell to the CIO with a really, really good connection with large deals and, you know, all sorts of things. And the CIO makes a decision. And then in that company, people have to use the thing that CIO chose. And my insight, you know, there and convinced the exec team to let me do this was, hey, if you look at all the interesting outcomes in collaboration in the last 10 years, when you look at things like, you know, Zoom and Figma and Canva and Slack, they all did this product like to growth technique, which is you focus on a beautiful end user product and experience that drives high engagement and virality. And you make sure that it's as easy to buy that product and engage with it as it is to buy toothpaste on Amazon. That's product-led growth. And if you do that, when the enterprise salesperson engages, they're entering an account where they say, by the way, I already have 500 users and they love the product. And usually it's finance and IT saying, hey, give me some control so it's not the Wild West on this product. It's not so expensive. And then you do a deal. Very different than coming in and pushing on a rope and saying, hey, you know, give this, your customers love it, right? Yeah. So so different that they created this own little unit. They put in, you know, Voicea. We launched a new product called Vidcast. There were a couple other acquisitions. Slido, you might have used it for audience polling. It's a great capability. WebEx events.
So this is a new role then, the GM of product-led growth?
Correct. Yeah. I see. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Cool. So last but not least, Omar, what can you tell us about your new venture?
The new horizon is, it's called Rembrand.
Rembrand.
And it's Rembrand without the T. It's as if, you know, Bluekind Voicea had a baby. And so essentially it's applying AI techniques to essentially generate virtual product placement videos. Let me step back on the why. People have shifted all their time, not all the time, but huge amounts of time to video and digital video. And within digital video, even shorter form video, huge amount of time. But think about how we monetize it. We monetize it with annoying, interruptive ads. And consumers have two reactions to that. Let me skip it. Is reaction number one, they want to skip it. Reaction number two is maybe I should pay a subscription so I don't have to see this. Don't bet against the consumer. In the long run, there's got to be a better way. And so what we believe is just like search started out with banner ads and then it went native with sponsored links and the rest was history for Google, right? When you did that, we believe video needs a native format. And we're not alone in this belief. There is a native format. It's called product placement. 2 years before Tom Cruise comes out with a movie, they're competing to figure out how to get, Ray-Ban is competing to figure out how to get in that movie. That's product placement. It takes a long time. It's super manual. It's a big industry. There's a secondary application in sponsored posts. I talked to one president of a CPG who would send out 2,000 packages to all these creators, you know, hoping it makes a way to some of the videos. And there's 4 to 6 weeks of negotiation on what they get to say, if they want to get paid, all that super, super manual, tens of billions of dollars. Our goal in life is to turn this into a programmatic industry, just like, you know, we saw it happen to advertising becoming programmatic. It became a $100 billion industry. We want to take this tens of billions of dollars manual industry, make it completely virtual programmatic. So our first line of business is, you know, creators that are working with us, upload a video to us. We will put in bids of products, here's a can of Coke, here's a box of chocolates, here's a, you know, a car on a poster in the wall. They get to choose which one is more authentic to them. They accept the bid and they upload the video and they get paid. We want to also expose that via API to movie studios, publishers, ad agencies, and let them, to your comment earlier on about what happened to DoubleClick, you know, we're going to be a two-sided network at first, but we're also going to launch APIs so people can just hit the tech.
That seems like you could also do targeting eventually. So try to figure out what kind of person that is and what sort of placement will be they'd be more likely to respond to. It wouldn't have to be driven by the creators. Seems like a no-brainer to me. But it does involve a heavy component of AI, right? Because you have to kind of blend the images into the video. And
Could I talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, please.
I have so many questions. So, yes.
Yeah. So pulled some really, really strong people out of Facebook AI research and Amazon and NVIDIA. We're 10-person team. 7 of them are building the tech. You've seen Stable Diffusion, OpenAI, and all these. They're fantastic, the astronaut sitting on the horse on the moon. Great stuff. That won't work in a world where it has to be super photorealistic in a moving video. So you have to create a different style of AI that is constrained by the laws of physics. And to explain what we do, let's talk about what you do every day. You, when you're looking at a real world scene, have a 2D image implanted on your retina, right? And your brain at 25 frames a second stitches together an illusion of continuity, even though it's only 25 frames a second, and it stitches together a 3D world, even though it was only a 2D imprint on your retina. So our brains are amazing. And so we have to write software that essentially takes a 2D set of frames coming in on a video and build a 3D scene in the model that has an understanding of where lighting is at every point in 3D space, and then has a notion of planes, because you have the product can't be floating in the air, and has to have a notion of scene changes, has to have a notion of material, which materials seem to reflect light and which don't, has to have a notion of occlusion. I'm moving my hands and it's covering the screen behind me. But in a virtual world, if I didn't understand those depth and movements, my product would show on top of my hand and not behind it. So the AI learns to do all those things. And it's a hard problem. That's why this didn't exist before.
It's like a video game.
Yeah.
Physics.
Yeah, you got it. That's exactly where you find some people who understand this stuff.
Wow. So what stage are you at now, Omar, at the time of this appearance of this podcast?
So we are just launching the company publicly. We've been obviously working on this for a while. We'll also be announcing our fundraise. And so seed round that we raised about $8 million for the seed. It gives us a couple years of runway. Nice. And we're kicking off also in this month a market trial in a couple of categories. First category, it's actually podcasting. Like I should have signed you up as a creator.
Come on.
There you go. Yes. And so podcasting in video form is our first category. Second category is lifestyle, which includes, cooking, wellness, and the such, and, a dozen, prominent brands. Put it together and see how people like it, get feedback on pricing, workflow, consumer reaction.
Have you talked to any creators sort of in your research phase and gotten feedback from them?
Oh, we've got several of them signed up, working with us, exciting, advising us. Yeah, they love this. You know, what's really interesting about the creators is that you see a certain style of interaction in their videos on YouTube. And then when you get with them on business, they're very entrepreneurial. Like really, really interesting.
They have to be.
Folks.
Yeah, they hustle. Yes. Yeah,
yeah, in ways that's that might not be apparent, in their videos when there's some entertainment in the video.
Why was podcast one of the first trial?
Really good question. The reason is that it has volume, but it's an easier AI problem because there are fewer camera movements and usually indoors and usually have some space that we could plant a product or a poster on.